Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. This is
the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, the spell you're under has been broken by Chris Jericho.
The People's Podcast has arrived. The remedy for boredom is here. Let's go for a ride with the modern day Indiana Jones. Josh Gates is with me, and he's super, super interesting because he and his team have traveled all over the world to investigate some of history's most iconic legends, age-old mysteries, ancient civilization, lost treasure, paranormal, cryptozoological sites and stories. So many things Josh has seen. If you've seen it in an Indiana Jones movie, chances are Josh has experienced it and gone through it. And I want to know more. I also want to say thanks to all of the sponsors of TIJ, the ones who let me do this for you for free for twice a week. And thanks to all of you for supporting my great sponsors, including Amazon. You know how to do it. You go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. Every time you use one of my Amazon links, Amazon kicks back a couple bucks to the show to help us cover production costs. I got links for Amazon USA, Amazon UK, Amazon Canada. Hey, you can get all kinds of cool stuff on Amazon. You get the latest Black Veil Brides record, Black Veil Brides 4, featuring Andy Biersack of Talk is Jericho alumni fame. Plus, you get Shawn Michaels' new book, Wrestling for My Life, The Legend, the Reality, and the Faith of a WWE Superstar. You got to check that out. Plus, you can get Josh Gates' book, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. So many cool stories. And I was watching Destination Truth over the last few weeks with Ash, the fish expert, and he loves the show. A lot of really unexplained mysteries on there, and I'm very excited to check out Expedition Unknown, Josh's new show, which is on the Travel Channel. You can also check out Fozzy's latest record, Do You Want to Start a War, which is on Amazon, and we're getting ready to hit Europe for the Cinderblock Party Tour, which begins. It begins. It's ready to rock, ready to go. I can't believe it's here already. We'll list all those dates coming up, but Do You Want to Start a War? Still riding high and running free. Plus, my third book, my third New York Times bestseller, The Best in the World at What? I have no idea. You can get that at Amazon as well, but you know the rules. You get anything you want at Amazon. Won't cost you anything extra. No hidden fees or challenges. Happen to be doing some online shopping? I want you to do it through my Amazon links. Help out this show. You go to podcastone.com. You click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page. You hit the Talk is Jericho button, and you can bookmark that right now so you can get to those links in one easy click. Well, it's hard to believe that the Y2J winter tour with the WWE has ended. In Buffalo on Sunday night. It was a great, great time. I can't believe it went by so fast. And I have to honestly say that I think these last 2 months have been two of my favorite months that I've ever had in the business. No stress, because a lot of times when you do TVs or pay-per-views, I'm not going to say there's a lot of stress where like you're mad or angry or anything like that, but there's just a lot of things you have to look into. There's a lot of corners that have to be, corners that have to be cut. Is that a saying? You got to cross the T's and dot the I's, and you have to have kind of no stone can be left unturned. And not that you don't do that on a live event as well, but it's a different vibe, and it's a lot more of a fun thing. You just take your time, take your chances, and do what you want to do, and really just feel the crowd a lot more. And anybody that goes to live events and the TV tapings will tell you the pros and cons to both. Obviously, TV tapings have more of the pomp and circumstance, and all the big angles happen on TV. But at the live events, there is less pressure and just more freewheeling. You want to say something to the crowd, say it. You want to try a new move or a new high spot, do it. So all that stuff kind of comes into play when you're on the live event schedule. And I had a really, really great time working just two guys. I did 16 shows, and I either worked with Cesaro or I worked with Luke Harper. And they're both great, great performers, and they're both very much coming into their own. There's pros and cons to every performer, but I think that Cesaro and Harper both have it worked out. Cesaro maybe needs a little bit more of a spark character-wise, and it's not from lack of trying. He's always trying different things, working on different things. And I actually think this new tag team that he's in with Tyson Kidd is going to help him to kind of find a little bit more, because whenever you're in the mix, you always get more confidence. I mean, when you're not in the mix and you're kind of just spinning your wheels, it's frustrating. And you know, it's hard to get your ideas on TV if you have no idea, if you have no TV time. So now that Cesaro's on TV with Kid, that will be a chance for him to get out there and do some things and kind of show some different personalities and show some different ideas, because he's got the TV time to be able to do that in. A perfect example of this is Curtis Axel. I mean, how awesome is Axel Mania? I'm a huge Axel Mania fan. I'm a big fan of Curtis Axel as well. But I love the fact that it was just kind of a throwaway thing. You know, he never got eliminated from the Royal Rumble. So now after 35, 36, 37 days, he's still in, quote-unquote, the Royal Rumble. And so he started Axelmania to talk about how he's going to WrestleMania. And, you know, Vince loves stuff like that, and the fans love stuff like that. Now they're chanting for Curtis Axel and chanting for Axelmania. And you would never, ever have guessed that. And that's so one of my favorite things about pro wrestling, is how there's just you just never know what's going to work and what's not going to work. And the fact that, you know, Curtis Axel is now one of the getting the biggest pops on Raw. It's a great testament to see if you have some creativity and how things can go for you. So thumbs up to Axel, who I did not work on this last tour, but thumbs up to Cesaro and to Harper. Both of them are great. Finished up the tour this weekend in Buffalo and Toronto, but of course, the crown jewel of any tour is Madison Square Garden. And I mean, I think a lot of times people kind of take that for granted, and I never do. Whenever I go into the Garden, it is a big deal. And I'm not sure if some of the guys that are coming into the business now understand just how monumental it is to be in the Garden. And it's more than just an arena. You know, I would work in the Garden for free. Really, just to get a chance to wrestle in there. And as a matter of fact, at one point it was just pitched that I would just do a highlight reel in the Garden. I was like, nope, I'm doing a match. Put me in there with somebody. Had a great match with Harper, and just the atmosphere and the feeling. If you walk around backstage at the Garden, there's all the, you know, the pictures up on the wall of all the greats that have performed there. And you see that quite often in newer arenas now. But I remember the Garden has had this for, gosh, since I've been going there. I think my first time was in 99. And, you know, all the new arenas have pictures up there, but there's not a lot of arenas that have a picture of John Lennon playing, George Harrison playing, Paul McCartney playing, at all solo gigs. You know, Tito Fuentes is up there, AC/DC, Springsteen, Billy Joel, Elton John. You know, it's the Mecca. If you've ever been in a band that's amounted to anything, you have done well at Madison Square Garden. And I've heard that, you know, there's a lot of times when you don't make money if you go to the Garden because of union fees and setup fees. And, you know, there's a very strict curfew. If you go over that, you got to pay overages and that sort of thing. And It doesn't matter. You do the Garden, because if you're going to have a presence in New York City, you play Madison Square Garden. That's just how it goes. End of story. Done deal. They've done some great renovations to the Garden over the years. So it was kind of getting to be one of those older places that you just put up with because it was the Garden. But now, I mean, the Tron is huge. It's amazing. The dressing rooms are great. And the sound system is incredible in the Garden, as it should be. But the real big selling point, we did a huge house there. It was like an $855,000 house, which is amazing. You know, that's the biggest of the big as far as live events goes. And for a while, actually, Cena and I had the record for the highest grossing WWE Garden show of all time. I believe that was in December of 2008. We had a cage match that Howard Finkel said was the greatest cage match he'd ever seen, which was pretty cool because Howard's seen, you know, I'm sure dozens of cage matches. But that crowd, that house, that gate was the biggest gate we'd ever had in Madison Square Garden up until that point. And maybe even for a pay-per-view as well, because I think pay-per-views and TV tapings, there's less seats available. So although they can probably charge more. But I think for a live event, for sure, it was the highest grossing Garden show of all time. But the big centerpiece of this show was the Hulk Hogan Appreciation Night. Now, all of us listening to Talk is Jericho love Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan, of course, being a Talk is Jericho alumni. He's been on the show twice. We did two episodes with Hulk back just a few months ago. Both of them have done huge ratings, by the way. And if you haven't heard them, you got to go check them out. But Hogan is the epitome of the WWE in Madison Square Garden, besides Bruno Sammartino. Don't get on my case and start tweeting me about, Bruno Sammartino main evented more. I get that. But if you're a guy my age, or a little younger, a little older, I mean, Bruno's in his 70s, I'm in my 40s. So for me, Hulk Hogan is the WWE in the 80s and is WWE in Madison Square Garden. I mean, you talk about WrestleMania 1 and, you know, just all the times when you would see Hogan in MSG. So they had the Hulk Hogan Appreciation Night, which was really cool. It started out with Jimmy Hart going to the ring and kind of announcing Hulk. Hulk came down and said a little speech. And then was interrupted by the NWO, who he did know was there, Hall and Nash. And then Hall and Nash played, I think, a highlight package of, you know, all the great stuff that Hogan has done. And then Flair came down, which nobody in the crowd knew Flair was going to be there. They knew that Hall and Nash were going to be there, but they didn't know that Flair was going to be there. So it was a big, big explosion when he came out to the ring, which was really cool. And Flair said some really nice stuff about Hogan, and it was a real love fest. And showed some more packages. And this is like kind of goosebump type stuff because you're not going to see this again. It's like one of those really cool once in a lifetime things. And then they bring down the operator of Madison Square Garden and one of the most famous photographers in Madison Square Garden history, who took a famous picture when Hogan won the title from the Iron Sheik back in 84. And of course, the Garden, New York City Garden crowd boos them like idiots, you know, typical New York City. I love New York City. You guys are great, great fans, but sometimes you can be real dummies. Like, why are you booing like one of the greatest sports photographers of all time? Like, why? Like, what's the point? Anyways, they give Hulk a big, you know, giant life-size print of this great picture that the guy took. I think his name is George. Sports historians will know exactly what his name is. And then Triple H came down and said a few more things. And then they raised this banner up to the ceiling. It said 30 years of Hulkamania. And I was so excited. Like, it's like, here you go. You got all the, you know, the numbers that have been retired over the years. You know, Rod Gilbert and Brad Park and Mark Messier and, you know, all those guys. And then you got all the banners from the New York Rangers over the years, from the Knicks, you know, all that sort of thing. You got a banner of Billy Joel in one corner for like 60 sellouts, Elton John, 60 sellouts, and then they raised the banner for Hulkamania, which was really, in reality, one of the coolest things I'd seen. I had a total goosebumps and all that. But then I just found out today that they took the banner down. Like, why wouldn't they leave that up there? Like, I thought that was a really cool thing. It's like 30 years of Hulkamania in the Garden, Hulk Hogan's banner risen to the sky. But they took it down, and that was kind of a real, like, it kind of pissed me off. Like, Hogan should still have that banner raised up in the sky, and it should stay there forever. I mean, everybody in New York City knows the WWE. Everyone in New York City knows Hulk Hogan, and I think Hulk's banner should still be up there. I don't know why they took it down, but whatever, at that point in time, for that night, raising that banner, and just the whole night as a whole, whether they keep the banner, whether they let them take the banner down, it was a very cool night that you'll never, ever forget, and it was a great way for me to end off the Y2J winter tour, and I hope to see you guys very, very soon. It's funny because I got a little t-shirt store up at ProWrestlingTees.com, and that's ProWrestlingTees, T-E-E-S.com. And I love the fact that people are like, well, we're seeing this pro wrestling tease. Does that mean you're never coming back to the WWE again? And it's like, it doesn't mean anything of the sort. I actually created that because I wanted to have some Talk is Jericho merchandise. We got four shirts up. There's a Master of Podcasts shirt, which is great, based on Master of Puppets. There's a Pod of Thunder shirt. And then there's an Armbar shirt and a Jericho Personal Security Ralphus shirt. And I put those two on there because I've seen people with bootleg versions of those, selling bootleg versions of those for years. So I'm stealing them back, guys. Sorry. Those are now official Jericho shirts. There's the Armbar shirt, Jericho Personal Security, Talk is Jericho Master of Podcasts, Talk is Jericho Pod of Thunder. If you like those ideas, they're like $20 each. Go to ProWrestlingTees, TEES.com/ChrisJericho and find them all there. If you want to buy them, great. If you don't, I don't care. I just wanted to put them up there so you guys would have the choice to get some cool looking swag from TIJ if you wanted them, because this is the best podcast in the world with over 63 million downloads so far. Yeah, thanks to you guys. A lot of diversity, a lot of cool people on here. Josh Gates, the modern day Indiana Jones, is coming up from Travel Channel's Destination Truth and Expedition Unknown. A lot of cool, amazing, fantastic stories.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
This is Talk is Jericho.
On the line right now is Josh Gates, and I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not jealous of a lot of people in my life. I've gotten to do pretty much everything I ever wanted to do, but you have a dream job, my man. You are the host of Expedition Unknown. You were the host of Destination Truth, and basically your job is you get to travel around the world looking for supernatural mysteries, legends. Dude, can I be you for a day, please?
Yes, of course. Anytime you want to switch places, it's fine. Although I will warn you, it's a lot of bad food and cramped airplane seats.
Well, and that's the thing. I'm sure when you're filming these episodes, we get to see the 60 minutes of the glorious stuff, but it's the other 23 hours that is the real job in all this, right?
For sure. I mean, look, I would never complain about it. I feel really lucky to be doing this. But yeah, it is one of those be careful what you wish for things.
Well, I mean, you're kind of a modern day like Indiana Jones in a lot of different ways. I mean, what do you call yourself?
I call myself modern day Indiana Jones. I print that on my business cards, actually.
Damn it!
No, you know, look, what we do on the show is we go around the world and we're investigating iconic legends and mysteries, everything from, you know, lost cities and vanished explorers to buried treasures and you know, supernatural relics and artifacts. And I think really what I'm trying to do is to go to these places and investigate these stories to see if there's any truth behind them. So I think I'm kind of part, you know, part adventure guy, part TV host, and also part storyteller and producer, I guess, trying to to really just go to these spots and bring our viewers along to experience these stories.
And this just basically started its Expedition Unknown on the Travel Channel. And what is the difference? Because we'll talk about Destination Truth later, because I'm really interested in a lot of those things. What Expedition Unknown is not so much focused on the monsters. It's more on artifacts and legends and that sort of a thing. What are the differences between the two shows?
Yeah, I mean, Destination Truth, which was, you know, awesome. I take nothing away from that experience. It was great. But it was in kind of a specific sandbox, right? It was the stories had to be either paranormal or they had to be cryptozoological, it had to be a ghost or a monster, and there wasn't really a lot of room for anything else. And it also had a format that I think was frustrating for those of us who made the show, which is that we kind of had to cram two adventures into each hour, which worked okay on Ghost Hunters when you were really just focusing on a domestic paranormal investigation. But when we were trying to travel halfway around the world and fit in some culture, fit in some travel, it just got really tight. And so Expedition Unknown, you know, I think takes some of the core DNA of Destination Truth, which is that it's still very much an adventure show. It's still fun and funny and very unexpected. But it allows us to do kind of a deeper dive and to explore the cultures a bit more, explore the destinations a bit more, and to focus a full hour on the topic at hand. And yeah, these are now legends and mysteries. Some of them have a supernatural element to them, but it's not strictly speaking like we're going on a monster hunt, you know?
Well, let's talk about some of the episodes. I'm assuming that you filmed them all. And what an undertaking this must be when I said you're a modern-day Indiana Jones. It's, you know, we're joking, but basically you guys are hitching up to do an expedition everywhere around the world. This is not something that's just happening within the United States.
Wait, you were joking when you called me that?
Well, not anymore. Not anymore. Now I'm serious. I want to be your short round. Look out, Dr. Gates.
It is a real undertaking, you know. I mean, these kind of stories, these legends, they usually take place in pretty far-flung places.
Well, let's talk about it. I mean, the first episode was basically about the mystery of Amelia Earhart. What was the new news that brought you to this case? I mean, you said you were looking for something that had a little bit of a buzz about it.
Right. You know, the Earhart story was really a great place for us to start, because it's probably the biggest mystery of the 20th century. You know, this was Earhart was probably the most famous woman in America when she disappeared, and her mystery the mystery surrounding her disappearance really still fixates us almost 100 years later.
She took off to fly around the world, or what was exactly she was trying to do?
That's right. She was trying to be the first woman to circumnavigate the globe. And so this was 1937. Mm-hmm. You know, aviation was still really in its early years, and this was a really difficult thing to attempt. She had a custom-built plane made by Lockheed, and she had attempted it once before and going the kind of counterclockwise direction, and she didn't make it past Hawaii in that attempt because she had a problem with her plane, had to be rebuilt. But she, on her final attempt, she had made it like two-thirds of the way around. She started from Oakland, California, and she took an eastern route, and she went down across South America, hopped the Atlantic, went across Africa, Asia. Hmm. She made it all the way to Papua New Guinea, so just off the coast of Asia, right above Australia, actually. She made it there, and then she had only a few more stops before making it back to Oakland. She had to go from Papua New Guinea to a very tiny island called Howland Island, and then from there to Honolulu, and from Honolulu to Oakland. And she knew that those last stretches were really the most dangerous part of the trip, because there were huge bodies of water with very little infrastructure out there in the Pacific. And so she never made it to Howland Island. She took off from Papua New Guinea and never landed. And so, you know, nearly 100 years later, we're still really fixated on what became of her plane. She had a navigator on board as well, who gets a little lost to history, but his name is Fred Noonan, and he vanished as well. And so the really crazy thing about the Earhart mystery is that if you ask like 10 different Earhart researchers, they'll give you 10 different theories.
Right.
You know, she crashed here. She sank there. She was taken prisoner by the Japanese. She was a spy herself. She faked her death. I mean, you hear all these wild theories about her.
A lot of legends about the legend, right? Yeah,
exactly. Right. It's one of those things where, because no trace of her ever turned up, it sort of spiraled off into, you know, legends upon legends. Mm-hmm. But there is kind of a new generation now of researchers that are out there trying to piece together what really happened to her. And there are some really interesting breaks in this case. There's a group called Tiger, And they are the Historic Aircraft Recovery Group, they're called. So they've been focused on Earhart now for decades. Hmm. And they recently announced that they found a piece of aluminum on a remote island in the Pacific that they think could be from her plane.
Wow.
And so, you know, if that could be proven, it would be huge, because it would be the very first trace of evidence of her in 75 years. So we basically looked at some of the most prominent theories out there about Earhart, including the theory that she may have crash-landed on this remote island. And then we go out and do our own investigation across the South Pacific, trying to chase down some of these leads and really see what we can find.
So you think she crashed on one of these islands around New Guinea?
You know, I don't know. I think the most – look, the simplest, most straightforward answer is the obvious one, which is that she couldn't find this very small island, mm-hmm. and she ran out of fuel, she ditched in the ocean, and she died. And that may be the case. You know, the fact of the matter is a lot of money has been spent searching the waters around where she should have landed, and there's been no trace of the plane.
Hmm.
That doesn't mean she didn't crash in the ocean. You know, the Pacific Ocean is vast and it's deep, so she could still be out there for sure. But there is some kind of circumstantial evidence that she may have crash-landed on a number of small islands near where she was intending to go. One of them is this little island called Nicomararo, where this aluminum panel was found. And the directors of this organization, they really believe that this is what happened. They're convinced that she crash-landed on this island. And so it's a fascinating theory, but it's not a done deal. You know, I mean, I think that until we have a plane, until we have...
Right.
A skeleton, you know, it's not a done deal.
So where are some of the other places that you've traveled and some of the other mysteries that you're trying to unravel?
Sure. The second episode in the run involves a lost city in Cambodia. And this is such a cool story because this is like right out of, you know, Indiana Jones. This is like a jungle covered, you know, temple city out in the wilds of Cambodia. And what's so cool about the story is that, you know, some of these stories are definitely real, things like Earhart, where we know that it's real, and some of them are legends. And in the case of this lost city, it sounds like it's something that's a myth or a legend, you know, but it's a real place. And archaeologists knew that this place was a real city. They had inscriptions that mentioned it at other temples in Cambodia, but they never were able to find it.
Hmm.
And they even kind of knew that it was on this one mountain, but they didn't know where. And they had searched for it for decades. And then recently a new technology was invented, this thing called, that I'd never heard of, this thing called LIDAR, which is a laser scanning technology that you mount to a plane or to a helicopter, and it basically pulses these lasers down into the jungle canopy, and it just like sees through the jungle.
Hmm.
And using this new technology, these archaeologists found this lost city just last year. So the episode
they actually found it.
This place. Yeah, they actually found it.
Wow.
So the episode involves us going to this lost city, taking cameras up into the jungles to investigate a place that, you know, nobody's laid eyes on for 1,000 years. And there is this great legend associated with the city that the king of the city, you know, had this mystical artifact that was like charged with the powers of the gods, you know, and that he could use this to kind of wield the power of the gods. So there's like this real Indiana Jones element of like, oh my God, this city exists. It's real. It's out there. And then there's this whole other level of like, what's with this crazy story about this guy that claims to have this, you know, magical artifact?
So when you approach these different expeditions, do you approach them completely from a scientific level? Do you have an open mind into believing that some of these things could be true? What is your attitude and thoughts towards it?
I mean, I think I first and foremost just approach them from an interest level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like when I hear stories like this, my ears just kind of perk up, right? It's like, if it's like, you know, something that sounds like it belongs in the Goonies, I'm like, I'm there. I'm in. I want to know what's actually going on there. But in terms of the kind of believability factor, I think, you know, making Destination Truth over at Sci-Fi kind of taught me to be a lot more open-minded about stories, because we were looking for some of the craziest stuff in the world on that show. And, you know, going into that job, I initially was like, all right, I'm going to go look for ghosts and monsters. Like, that could be kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet you most of this stuff is crazy and there's not a shred of truth to it. And I kind of left that series feeling like, you know, most of the stories that we investigated, the people that we met that thought that they saw a creature in the
yeah.
woods or something in the lake, they had a real experience.
See, that's the way I look at it too. If you know, whether it's crazy or not, they believe it. So therefore something mm-hmm. is going on.
Totally. And even if what they saw wasn't Bigfoot or wasn't a lake monster, you know, it's a real mystery, right? The story is real. Mm-hmm. So to me, that was, you know, that's cool. Like what's actually going on here? You know, when we talk about things that we're looking for, on Expedition Unknown, you know, we're looking for this ancient Viking artifact that in these Viking legends, it was this weird crystal that, you know, was like magical that the Vikings could use to navigate the seas, and it would allow them to navigate, kind of by the power of magic in a weird way. So, you know, you look at that story and you go, okay, there's probably not a magic crystal out there that could be used to navigate the world's oceans. But now the question is, was this a real thing? Was this some crystal with like natural properties that kind of acted like a compass? And now there's a school of thought that maybe this thing, which is called the Viking Sunstone, could have been real. And so sometimes like the real world answer to what's actually going on is kind of like just as interesting.
Well, and the thing is too, Josh, like let's say we were, you know, hanging out in 1965 and I said, you know, someday there will be a magical screen where you can write in an address and it will take you there no matter where it is. You'd be like, you're crazy. This could be kind of like the reverse version of that. Like maybe there was some kind of a crystal, like you said, that had some kind of geomagnetic properties or something that could lead you into the right place.
I mean, absolutely. And that's, I mean, you know, even not even the 1960s, 5 years ago, 10
yeah,
years
exactly,
ago,
right,
half, of the,
right.
half of the things we have today seem like science fiction, you know? So for sure, I think that, you know, a big part of what we're trying to do is to, you know, get out there and just explore these things and see where the stories take us. And I think part of the fun of the show is we don't always know where it's going to lead us. And that's what makes it exciting.
Let's talk about something in one of the expeditions close to home. I'm reading some of the descriptions here. And first of all, the Cambodia Lost City is actually called the Temple of Doom. Once again, modern day Indiana Jones. there's another one talking. The name of the show is Jesse James. It's in Oklahoma. And you're searching for the buried gold of Jesse James. Tell us about the legend behind this and what you may or might not have found or the process behind it.
Yeah, you know, Oklahoma might not on face value sound like the most exotic destination in the world.
Right.
But actually, it is a pretty incredible story. You know, Jesse James is one of these guys that, like, everybody knows the name, right? Everybody knows, oh, yeah, Jesse James, he was, like, an outlaw, you know. But people don't have a really clear understanding. I think they do more now because there's been a few films made about him in the last few years. But, you know, James was a real guy, and he lived in a really kind of, you know, in insane moment in history when the country was really being torn apart around the Civil War. And he was a bad guy. I mean, there's really no, you know, there's no ambiguity.
He was an outlaw.
James, yeah, he was a bad dude. I mean, he killed a lot of folks and killed a lot of folks he probably didn't need to kill. And he and his gang robbed a lot of different places. They robbed banks, they robbed stagecoaches, they robbed people. And they buried a lot of their money. A lot of these guys in that era, you know, there's no safe place to kind of keep your loot. And they would go out into the woods and the hills and the mountains, and they would draw maps, and they would bury treasure. It was a real thing. It was like the safest place to put something. You know, you couldn't put it in the town bank. Some robber would come along and take that. And so there is this particular legend about this huge treasure that James and his gang stole from Mexico, that they went down into Mexico and stole gold bullion that was being transported, and they drove it up into the mountains of Oklahoma and buried it up in the mountains, and it's never been recovered. And so it's one of these cool stories where, you know, look, not only could there be millions of dollars of gold bullion out there yet to be discovered, but it could be like right in your own backyard. I mean, this could be here in the United States.
So that's what I'm saying. It's such a fantastic thing. Like, you could actually go and, you know, go dig in a hill in Oklahoma, and suddenly you found millions of dollars worth of gold. What kind of clues do you get to take you to the right place that's going to lead you in the right way?
That's the thing. People always say to me, like, oh, I wish I could do what you do and go have adventures. And I'm like, go to Oklahoma. Like, there's buried treasure right here, maybe.
Come on, like, man.
You can have the adventure of a lifetime. Like, you can get in a car, you know?
Right, it's all there.
And there's a ton of that's been written about the legend, and there's like these crazy old maps, and you meet these hilarious like professional treasure hunters they're all kind of like these kooky guys who go out there, and this is what they do, this is their life, and they want to find this stuff, and like you kind of meet them and you're like, are these guys crazy? And then like an hour into it, you're like, these guys are going to find this, you know, like.
And that's the secret to any, you know, quote unquote, I think reality show or adventure show, whether you're talking about, you know, gator hunters or whatever they are, it's not so much what you're doing. It's the people that you meet along the way. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I like about these expeditions that you're having, these adventures that you're having. Whether it's real or not, you're meeting people who think that it is. And that's half the fun.
Totally. And it's also because, you know, you have to find a way to – it's really hard now to make TV that's not educational, but that's, like, even remotely informative. Like, it's just tough. You know, we live in a time where people are very immediate and there's kind of short attention span. So, you know, trying to tell people about – lost civilizations and ancient history and stuff like that. You have to find good characters and you have to find ways to do it kind of in the moment and really make it a real adventure, or it's just like folks are going to change the channel, you know?
Absolutely. But there's plenty of mysteries and legends out there. Tell me a little bit quickly about the Amber Room that you went looking for in Germany and Russia.
This is a really cool story. This is like a trivia question. You know, if you ask people, what's the most valuable object ever to be stolen? You know, most people would probably guess a diamond or a painting of some kind, but it's actually this thing called the Amber Room. And it was an entire room that was stolen. It was a room in this opulent palace in St. Petersburg, in Russia. And it was covered in amber and gold and, you know, precious metals. And the castle was plundered by the Nazis in World War II. And the Nazis, took this entire room, broke it down, packed it into crates, and then shipped it out of Russia on trains back into Germany, and it was never seen again. And so there's this great long-standing debate as to whether or not the Amber Room was destroyed in an Allied attack in Germany, or whether it survived and is still hidden out there waiting to be discovered.
I mean, that is, you know, that's completely, you know, Indiana Jones 5 right there, you know.
How cool is that?
So when you have, like, you're talking about all these different legends and expeditions that you go to, do you have to go find, like, some kind of a Nazi expert? Or who is giving you the information that you need to put together a show that's going to be halfway, you know, interesting and exciting, where you're not just kind of trying to knock down walls and find it behind a door or something?
Totally. I mean, we're trying to meet, you know, scientists, archaeologists, researchers that are kind of on the cutting edge of these stories, people that are out there close to finding out the next step, the next clue, or to solving these things altogether. So we're looking for, you know, who are the people out there that are trying to recover this stuff? In the case of, you know, Jesse James, you're talking about treasure hunters, and that can be kind of an eclectic community of people. But you're trying to say, okay, who are the best treasure hunters out there looking at this? And also historians and other people who can help, you know, offer some context to the story.
Do you ever meet any kind of resistance? Like, you know, if I'm a treasure hunter and I see all these city slickers coming to town, you know, trying to investigate and trying to dig up my stuff, I don't want you around. I'm going to lead you to the other side of the desert.
Sometimes we had one of the treasure hunter guys in the Jesse James episode had this map. But, like, he didn't want to show it, you know?
Right.
And then I sort of struck a deal with him where I said, well, what if you just show it to me, but we don't put it on TV? I can just look at it. And he was like, okay. He was like, I could kind of get my head around that. And then I looked at it, and it was like gibberish. It was just like lines and X's. It's like, dude, nobody's going to interpret your map.
There was an X under a palm tree.
Yeah, I was like, don't worry, you're okay. Nobody's going to go find the gold with this thing. And then, you know, sometimes, like, we in the Earhart story, we had a guy who was convinced that he knew where Earhart's plane was, but, you know, he wanted me to fly all the way to, like, the Solomon Islands in the Pacific, but he wouldn't tell me anything. You know, he wouldn't tell me any coordinates or you know, give me any proof that he'd found something. So, you know, usually that's a sign that you're dealing with someone who's a little out there.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
On the line right now is Josh Gates. Let's talk a little bit about your previous show, Destination Truth, which you did for five seasons, and it was actually even called Monster Hunter overseas.
Right.
You know, anytime you're doing a show that can last one, two seasons, five seasons, especially about something as eclectic as the supernatural and monsters and cryptozoology, I mean, that must have been very eye-opening for you as well to know that there's that many legends out there.
Oh, it was amazing. I think when we started Destination Truth, my first instinct in that first season was like, are we going to be able to even get a second season out of this?
Right.
How many monsters are out there to look for? And it turns out there's so many of these stories about people having weird encounters with, you know, things they can't explain, both biological creatures and paranormal phenomena. It's like a pretty endless well of stories. And once you get into the ghost world, it's really endless. You know, there's just so many people have stories about what they think are paranormal encounters.
Well, I've been pitching for a while, not so much lately, about a lake monster show. And the reason why is I've always had an affinity for it, always had an interest in it. And if you go and look up lake monsters, you can find like hundreds, even 1,000,
totally.
One of the cryptozoologists I've had on the show, about all the different you know, legends about that. Tell us a little bit about some of them that you looked for on Destination Truth. I'll read a couple of them to you. I know there was one called the Naga in the Mekong River.
That was in Thailand, right? There's a sort of a serpent-like creature there. We looked for something called the Ogopogo in Canada.
I know that one for sure.
Yeah, we looked for a kind of a lake monster in Sweden, out in the ocean of Sweden. One in Cyprus. And, you know, it's like they come in a few different varieties. You know, some people describe seeing kind of giant serpents in the water. Some people describe something that looks more like a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. There's no shortage to those kind of stories. And I have to say, on Destination Truth, those were always the creepiest investigations for me, because I almost always believed that they saw something, mm-hmm. you know. And so it was like, all right, this might not be a lake monster, but it might be a crocodile. It might be a huge snake.
Sure, a giant tadpole, whatever. I don't want to be swimming with it.
Yeah. Anything like and it was always, you know, all those lake monsters stories. It's like you never dive in and the water's like crystal clear. It's always like murky, dark,
right?
Spooky water, you know.
Was there any stories that you heard that you were told, you know, I'm sure through interpreters for some of them, that were really creepy from that era?
You know, I think for me, the really creepy lake monster stories were always where, you know, you would meet these eyewitnesses that were like really rational, normal people who were not like profiteering off of it. They weren't trying to get rich off of it. They were trying to write a book about it. They were just like shaken up by something. And mm-hmm. there would be instances where, remember in that, I think it was in the Canada one, we met this woman who, she was like part of a group of like 20 people that saw this thing. They were all together on the shore. It wasn't just like, yeah, she said she saw it. It was like a whole bunch of people saw it, you know? And,
mm-hmm.
And it had movement, and it wasn't, you know, they would say, oh, it's a log and it's at the surface and this and that. And their descriptions were really kind of vivid and active. And you sit there and you listen to this and you go, well, they saw something. I mean, it's like 20 people didn't get together and decide to make this thing up.
Right.
You know? So that's what to me was so cool about that show, is that it's like, now I'm kind of like, all right, what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like what's really going on here?
When I was a kid, my grandparents grew up, my grandparents were living in Kelowna, which is right on the banks of Lake Okanagan, which, as you know,
yeah,
is where the Ogopogo
right.
is. And I used to go fishing with my grandfather, and he knew that I was scared of the Ogopogo. So he would take bologna and say, this is Ogopogo's favorite delicacy. And he'd throw it in the lake and he'd go, Ogopogo, have some bologna. And I remember being on the bottom of the boat just screaming like, Grandpa, stop, stop. I was convinced that Ogopogo would rise from the depths, eat my grandfather, and then flip over the boat and then drag me down to the depths. So that's how
and eat the bologna.
And eat the bologna, exactly, as the extra exclamation point on it. So I will not go in Lake Okanagan, man. So there's no Ogopogo stories for me in the future.
I don't blame you. That is like such a classic grandfather move.
I know, right?
Torment a young boy.
What were some of the other creatures that you were looking for that you found some interesting stuff about?
I always loved the Yeti story. You know, the Yeti is like the Himalayan version of the Bigfoot story. And,
of course.
And I always thought it was always like my favorite of all the monster stories. And it was just because I don't know, it's just something about the idea of this, like, this lone creature living up at high altitude in the Himalayas is sort of, you know, the abominable snowman. I just always thought that was such a cool story. And, going to the Himalayas, we investigated for it in a few different countries. We looked for it in Nepal and up in Bhutan, which is a really remote spot up in the Himalayas. And what's really cool about the Yeti stories is that you can travel to different countries up there that are geographically disconnected, that have different cultures, different peoples, and yet they all kind of have this very similar story about this thing that they've seen. And they have a real reverence for it. They have a real respect for it and in some ways a fear of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's, like you said, that's become so big. Not like there's Yetis, there's Sasquatch, there's Bigfoot. We've had a couple Bigfoot experts, Sasquatch experts. And to me, it's like, you know, it's the same thing with lake monsters or anything where you're talking about an expansive area, whether it be, you know, snow-covered mountains or whether it's forests of trees or whether it's a giant ocean. Are we really so egotistical as to think we know every single thing that is in that area, even though we've never even explored half of that place?
For sure. I mean, we just went on Expedition Unknown. One of our first episode, the Earhart episode, took us to Papua New Guinea, mm-hmm. which is the last place that she took off from, as I was saying earlier. But
right.
it also is one of the wildest nations on Earth. This is a place where they're finding not just like, oh, one new species this year. They're finding dozens of new species every year in the jungles and in the waters around Papua New Guinea. So there's still a lot out there to be discovered. In the world's oceans, there's no question. There's a ton of stuff still to be discovered.
Have you ever had any close encounters or any paranormal experiences or even brushes with death doing all these adventures that you've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of knock on wood over here. We've been very lucky over the years. I think in terms of wildlife, we've had a couple of close encounters with snakes, I think, more than anything. You know, I mean, one of the things about the big predators when you go out in the jungle at night is that for the most part, they're really skittish. You know, it's really
yeah.
rare to run into a tiger or something like that. You know, we would be in tiger, jungles that had tigers, and then we would talk to local guides and stuff, and they would say, you know, we've never even seen a tiger here. It's like they're just, those animals tend to be very reclusive. But snakes and things like that, which are small, can be aggressive and are often out at night and kind of underfoot, can be real, you know, game over kind of encounters. And, you know, I remember we did one episode in Indonesia where there was a pit viper in a tree at eye level that we almost just walked into, you know, because they camouflage so well. And stuff like that is terrifying.
You know, well, that's the thing. You're out there looking for, you know, a Bigfoot and, you know, you could actually get bitten by a real life, you know, monster. That's probably something you don't really expect.
No, not at all. But it's something that you have to be really careful about because that kind of stuff is out there and it's real hard to see. And so, I mean, think for us, snakes in particular, were always one of the big fears of making that show, you know, and we ran into cobras and fertilances and other stuff over the years, and they're just they're dangerous things.
Absolutely, yeah.
In terms of paranormal encounters, you know, I really started at Destination Truth as not a hardened skeptic, but I always said an open-minded skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
But I always heard like so many of the ghost guys, like, you know, Jay and Grant from Ghost Hunters, talk about, you know, you're going to get punched, slapped, kicked, they're going to reach out and grab you. And I just was like, boy, that's never happened to me. I've never experienced anything like that. And now that I've done the show, I have had a number of experiences where I totally can't explain what happened to me. I had an experience in China. We were filming an episode on the Great Wall of China and the supposedly haunted section of the Great Wall. And we used to wear these kind of goofy backpacks on the show that had a bunch of camera equipment strapped to them.
Uh-huh.
And the camera operator would sometimes come behind me and make adjustments to the backpack. And you'd get kind of jostled around a little bit while they were back there changing a battery or changing a tape. And I remember this happening up on the Great Wall and him being behind me and being kind of rough with me and me turning around to sort of say something to him. And there's like nobody behind me. You know, and there was a tree behind me. There was no wall behind me. I just thought he was behind me, and he was like 20 feet back. And it was like my blood just, you know, ran cold. It was like I suddenly just every hair on my body stood up because I just realized that, like, you know, I could not at all explain what just happened.
You're putting yourself in that position. You know what I mean? You're almost like you're playing with the Ouija board going, okay, what you got? Come on, paranormal, mm-hmm. weird stuff. Hit
totally.
Me. You know,
but of course,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, but of course, the real crazy thing about putting yourself in those positions and going into those places is that, for me at least, it's always that battle between, like, you know, I don't know what I'm more scared of, if I'm more scared of a ghost or I'm more scared of, like, the human mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like what, you know, your imagination can produce terrifying things. And so it's always that question of, did I just see something, or am I so keyed up and freaked out right now that I thought I saw something? But in the case of what happened in China, it was like I felt something.
Yeah, you knew something was beyond just your imagination there.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the werewolf legends that you investigated.
There's a number of those around the world. You know, I think what's so cool about that story is that, you know, it's such a pop culture creature for us now. It's
especially now with Twilight. Monsters.
Exactly, right? And it's just so kind of in our pop culture sphere, and yet it has this really interesting background, and it's a weird myth that pops up in different parts of the world. It pops up in South America, in Argentina, pops up in Spain, it pops up in Romania, places like that. But there's a whole bunch of different kind of ways into it. Sometimes it's a curse, sometimes it's sort of just a monster that lurks in the shadows. Sometimes it has these odd kind of like, like in Argentina, there was this myth that if you were the seventh son in a family, you could turn into a werewolf and things like that. But, you know, it's one of those things that I think there's probably not any good evidence of there being any real kind of world, you know, component to that nowadays, especially. But it does have these really interesting roots in folklore, and that makes it a cool story to me.
Well, and it's something we just discussed this too, Josh, where, hey, who knows where it started? Maybe somebody got rabies, got bitten by a dog and got rabies, then just went nuts and went feral and started attacking somebody. And that was passed down from generations. And to be honest with you, if you're losing your mind and you're biting people because you got bit by a dog, guess what? You're a werewolf.
That's right. That's totally
you
true.
You know?
And we've seen people who have, you know, we've all seen those photos, people who have that, particular disorder where they grow hair all over their body.
Yeah,
and
wolf
people
boy.
Used to be like sideshow performers and stuff, right? But, you know, 100 years before that, those people would have been, seen as real, legitimate monsters in some cases.
That's a great point. Let's go to something that's a little bit more real. I heard actually from a lot of different people that the Chernobyl episode that you did was pretty crazy, and even yourself mentioned that it was one of the scariest places you've ever visited.
Yeah, I don't know why I thought that was going to be such a fun night.
We got some good clubs in Chernobyl, man.
Yeah, we were hanging out in the office thinking about upcoming episodes for the show, and we were trying to, you know, we were on this kick of trying to go to like iconic places to do paranormal episodes, and I forget who even pitched it out, but somebody was like, "What if we went to Chernobyl?" You know, is that? And then we were like, "Yeah, what if we did? Is that even possible?" And we started researching it, and it turns out that it is possible, although it is, you know, a really kind of dangerous place to explore. You know, for anyone listening who doesn't really know the story, it was the site of the world's worst nuclear accident. Mm-hmm. There was a nuclear reactor at Chernobyl in the Ukraine that melted down in, I want to say it was 86, 84.
Yeah, in the 80s, 86. For sure, yeah.
But there was a town built next to the reactor called Pripyat, and the town was more like a city, actually. It's a pretty big place. And it was built specifically for the workers who ran the nuclear reactor. And when the reactor melted down, they evacuated this town, and nobody was really allowed to return. And so there's this entire ghost city in the Ukraine, and it's not like, oh, there's an abandoned building. It's like street after street of abandoned buildings.
The whole city is abandoned.
Totally abandoned. And I mean, it's like I Am Legend or
right,
The Walking
sure.
Dead. I mean, it's like there's a hospital, there's a school, there's a movie theater, a civic center, a carnival, you know, department stores, it goes on and on and on. And it's terrifying being there, but it's also like, what's behind that door? What's in there? You know, you just kind of want to see it, but you're also just super freaked out.
How can you go in there? Like, is all the radioactivity gone now at this point?
It's kind of sketchy. Like if you're on the main roads, because of time and wind and rain, most of the radioactive material has been washed away. So we had on the big, you know, kooky spacesuits.
Oh, so you're wearing the outfits.
We were fully kitted up because we were going to be there for such an extended period of time. And we had these, you know, you have Geiger counters, but you also have these things called dosimeters, which are kind of like personal Geiger counters that you strap on your arm. And it's kind of like a turkey thermometer timer in the oven, you know, like it basically gets your accumulated radiation. And when you've had enough, it kind of dings and says, you're done. You know, you need to get out.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. It's sort of a, just, it measures your accumulated intake. And so, I remember it was so funny when we went there, we handed them all out. You're supposed to strap them on your arm, and everybody got one. And I look over, my cameraman was just strapping it to his belt right in front of his crotch. You know, he was like, this is the area. This is what I'm worried about.
It's here. Like when you go for an x-ray and you get that lead apron, you know, you're double wrapping it around your ball bag for sure.
Totally. So, you know, it's like, but the thing about these Ukrainian guys, I mean, what's so weird is like, there's still this like kind of, you know, small ghost team of people who run the reactor. I mean, the
really
they have to monitor to make sure that it doesn't kind of collapse again. So there's like this weird skeleton crew of Ukrainian officials there who kind of, you know, their job is to just keep an eye on this thing. And so we went around with them to explore the city, and, you know, they have these big Geiger counters, these old Russian Geiger counters and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was always like, all right, what's the number that has to pop up on this thing for us to turn around? Like, explain to me what the number is. That's like, you never get a clear answer out of them because they're also like blasé about everything. They're like, oh, it'll be okay. You know, it's okay.
They all got no teeth. They got no teeth and no hair.
Totally, right? They're all like, yeah, they're all
stay as long as you want to. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, it was maybe the coolest place I think we ever went on Destination Truth, but also I think one of the only places I'd probably never go back to.
Well, that hits home just how dire a situation could get and how lucky that we are. I mean, we always laugh about the nuclear age and the Cold War and all this and the other thing. And even the other day, you know, I saw the interview, you know, the movie that had all the controversy with North Korea and everything. But like, if there was some kind of a nuclear meltdown or one bomb set off, we're done, you know, and then you can see that when you go to a place like Chernobyl.
For sure. And I'll tell you what, it's scary. You know, that reactor, when it melted down because a fire started inside the reactor and it breached the, you know, containment system in the reactor. So I think the amount of radioactive material that escaped the reactor was like 2% of the material.
Wow.
And that was enough to not only make the city next door unlivable, but they basically had to put a pin. You know, if you were to take a map, you could put a pin where the reactor was and you could go out from that pin, you know, 30 kilometers, so 20-something miles, 20 miles, let's call it, and you could draw a circle around that reactor. So you're talking about essentially a 40-mile across
radius,
hole in the middle of Ukraine, in the middle of Europe, that is unlivable for hundreds of years.
How do you get in there? Like, do you just drive there, or do you have to get permits, or...?
You have to get permits and say, I want to go in and check this place out. They actually do if you really are into it, you can go and do like a day tour now of the inner of the city of Pripyat. They'll take people around in like a van and show them for a few hours and then get out of there.
I'm envisioning like when you go to a Holiday Inn and there's all those pamphlets at the front desk that tell you where to go. Come to Chernobyl, spend the day.
Bring the kids.
The hottest city in the world. Wow. another place that was amazing was King Tut's tomb. And you spent the night. I mean, how do you get into – do you make a reservation? Like, how does that work?
That was the ultimate, like, I never thought that was going to happen.
That's insane.
We – totally nuts. That was like it never should have happened even. Like, we wanted to do it. We just thought – I mean, it's you know, Tut's tomb is famously supposedly cursed, and all these people who opened his tomb died. And we thought, how cool would it be to go, you know, do a one-on-one session down in the tomb? Because he's down in the tomb still. You know, a lot of those royal mummies in Egypt – they're back in Cairo now in the museum. Tut is still in the tomb in like a glass case in the actual tomb.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we in a lot of these countries, you need what's called a fixer. And a fixer is just really a local producer, someone who speaks the language, who knows the customs, who knows the politics, the permits, all that kind of stuff. So in Egypt, we were looking for a local fixer, and somebody said, oh, I got the guy. He worked on Amazing Race. He's done a bunch of stuff. He's the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave me his number, and I called him, and he's like this young guy. He's like 25 years old, but his dad is a fixer, and they're, you know, it's like this family business. And he speaks perfect English, and he's a really, really nice guy. And I get on the phone with him, and he says, what do you want to come here and do? And I'm kind of afraid to come out and say it, right?
I'm
kind of afraid to just be like, oh, I want to spend the night. It just seems like so ridiculous. So
yeah.
I'm like, well, you know, we want to go to the museum and film King Tut's mask, which, you know, you're not supposed to film. And he was like, oh, please, $50. And I said, oh, okay. Well, we also want to go to the pyramids and be there before sunrise when you're not allowed to be there. And he's like, oh, $200.
Come on, I mean, give me a challenge.
It was like everything I threw at him was like, you know, it was like ordering from a Chinese menu. It was like, it just, like, you name it, there's a price next to it, that's it.
Right.
And then that's exactly what he said, actually, after a couple of minutes. He's like, come on, like, give me, like, what do you really want to come do here? This is easy, you know? And I said, well, what I really want to do is I want to go there and spend the night in King Tut's tomb. And he sort of paused. The line went quiet for a minute, and he said, okay, I need about 30 minutes. Let me give you a call back. And so 30 minutes later, I got back on the phone with him, and I forget what it was. I forget what the price was. It was like, you know, he had a number in mind. It was not as much as I thought it should have been. I forget it was 10,000, 5,000, something. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'll let you know. And I called the Sci-Fi Channel, and I said, here's what this is going to cost. And they will permit it. It will be on paper. It won't be illegal. It'll be the, you know, we'll permit this. Do you want to do it? And they said, sure. Hmm. So we made this arrangement, went to Egypt, and this guy was Johnny on the spot with everything. He met us, you know, we just before we filmed there, another show had gone to Egypt, and they never made it out of the airport because they couldn't get their gear through customs because it's such a shakedown there. Like, it's a really tough place to film.
Yeah.
And, you know, this guy was, like, at the gate. The gear got out of the airport in 10 minutes, went to the pyramids, filmed the mask, the whole thing. And then the night that we're supposed to go out into the desert where the tomb is, we went out there at 5 o'clock at night when everything closes. All the tourists are coming out. We're going in. And he calls me over, and he introduces me to a couple guys and guards and handshaking and things like that. And then someone puts a key in my hand and says, okay, go ahead, have fun. And I just thought, no way. Like, no way. So that's it. You just got to know a guy. Like everything.
Yeah, I know a guy who knows a guy. So you go into King Tut's tomb, and you bring a sleeping bag or whatever. You know, I mean, come on, man. I mean, like I said, we can be as scientific as we want, or you can be as skeptical as you want. You go inside King Tut's tomb overnight, and you know the legends that if you go in here, you're probably going to die or cursed for life. I mean, you must have been a little bit skittish that night, to say the least.
You know, I was, but it was kind of like I was so excited that it had worked and that it had happened, that as freaky as it was, and it was actually really strange there, I the whole time, though, I just felt like I was on a high. You know, I was just so excited to be there. I was just like a kid in a candy store. But it's really funny, when we were outside the tomb setting up all the equipment and the cameras and stuff, it was like a perfectly clear night, and this huge sandstorm kicked up and was like trashing our equipment and tarps and all this stuff. And it was just like, right, of course, of course.
Of course. Right, it's the curse, it's the warning, you know?
That's right, yeah.
I heard that your mummy was really happy that you did that.
Hello.
What's the most out there claim that you've investigated that you left thinking, going, like, this could be real? Was there ever one or two or ten?
I think for me, the ones that I most end up thinking are real are not necessarily the most out there ones. A lot of them are like these mystery creatures, mystery primates in certain places. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a story in Indonesia about this kind of, it's like a Bigfoot, except it was sort of smaller. It was like this kind of, you know, kind of halfway between like an orangutan or like a Bigfoot. And I remember leaving thinking, yeah, that thing's probably there. Like, there's probably, you know, there's probably an uncatalogued primate species living in that jungle. Because some of these places, like, I don't know, like, I'm kind of a skeptic on the U.S. Bigfoot thing, only because, like, I know there's a ton of wilderness out there, mm-hmm. but it just feels like we maybe should have come across something by now, you know?
Right.
But in some of these places, like in this place in Indonesia, these jungles were so impenetrable. And we met with these conservationists that were working there. One of them was an elephant conservationist. And they had elephants in these jungles. She'd been there for 10 years. She'd never seen an elephant.
Wow.
And they have droppings, and they have bones, and they have remains. But she'd never seen one. They're just so reclusive, and the jungle is so hard to investigate. So I left there thinking, yeah, maybe this, I mean, Christ, if they can't find an elephant in there.
And
know?
They can't find an elephant, and they know that it exists, right? Like you said.
Totally.
So, and you know, there's a lot of different, I know there's the Amazon River dolphin, which should not be there, you know, an actual flesh-colored dolphin that lives in the jungle, or sorry, in the river there. There's also like a new species of tapirs, you know what those are? Like those rhinoceros things. So they're finding a lot of new species all the time. So why not, right?
Exactly. And that's kind of what what I think Expedition Unknown is about and what Destination Truth was about is that whether you're a skeptic, whether you're a believer, the really cool thing about it, I think, is that it's a real adventure, you know? And I think one of the things that's sometimes kind of a bummer is that it feels like we live in a time where everything feels kind of mapped and, you know, done and explored. And, mm-hmm. and it feels to a lot of people, I think, like there's not a lot of mystery out there still. And yet, there really is. There's just so much of the world that hasn't really been cataloged and explored. And I think that what we're trying to do is shine a light on that to tell people, you know, hey, there's still cool stories out here.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of different things that we still don't know about. Final two totally. Questions. What's your? Is there a favorite episode of Destination Truth that stands out for you? And is there a favorite episode of Expedition Unknown that stands out for you?
I think for me, in terms of Destination Truth, my favorite episode to film, which might not be my favorite you know, one-on-one to watch. But I think my favorite one to film was our trip to Antarctica. You know, we went down to the bottom of the world, and it was a place that I just wasn't sure that I was ever going to get to go to, and such a hard place to reach. And we went down there, and you know, so hard to film down there. It was one of those things that just was personally really satisfying that we managed to pull it off, you know?
What were you looking for when you went down there?
We were doing a paranormal thing. We were like, all right, let's do the world's most remote ghost hunt, you know? Hmm. And there are all these abandoned whaling stations and research stations down there, these buildings that are like, you know, it's like something out of like The Thing, you know, these mm-hmm. totally forgotten facilities down there. And so, and a lot of them have these cool ghost stories attached to them. So we went and investigated those and took this way too tiny sailboat down there from the bottom of South America. That's just really cool. It was just really hard to film.
It's interesting. I just had Robert Trujillo from Metallica on, and they played a show in Antarctica just to be the only band that's ever played on all seven continents. And he said that the penguins would just come up to them because they're not afraid of men. They haven't been taught to be afraid of man. He said totally. The wildlife would act differently. Did you notice that too?
I totally noticed that. It was like they just are like – it's like why aren't they like waddling away? They just – they don't care.
Mm-hmm. Just yeah, coming to hang out.
Totally. And it made it a lot easier for me to club and kill them.
So. Yeah, right. Of course. Yeah, sure. You're evil. Get that on film.
but I think for me, the most, one of the real favorite episodes was this purportedly haunted forest in Romania. And it's a place that we visited a couple times in the show. And I had a camera operator, and the first time we went there who, you know, this is a guy who's like, you know, he's out there to film the show. He's not a paranormal guy. He's not he's not in it for the ghost stories. And
right.
He's out there
to do a job.
He's there to do a job. And he had this insane experience where he effectively got like blown off of his feet. You know, he was sitting and he got kind of blown backwards off his feet. And I watched it happen on camera. We were filming him when it happened. And I ran over there afterwards and we sort of, you know, helped him. He was sort of shaken up and he was like, beyond terrifying.
Wow.
I mean, it was like something had just happened to him, something physical had just happened to him. And that was, to me, though it didn't happen to me, it happened to my camera operator. It was one of the craziest things I ever saw making that show because it was just so visceral and freaky.
Unexplainable.
Think, totally. Yeah. I mean, just like wild. Hmm. And I think for Expedition Unknown, you know, our trip for Amelia Earhart was really cool, but I actually think that the second episode in Cambodia is for me one of the highlights of the show, just because to be able to document a city that really nobody's seen before, and it's a really difficult place. The jungles around the city are covered in landmines, so we had to go through
wow.
a landmine jungle, and we went out there with these landmine experts and worked with these guys as they cleared landmines. I mean, anyone now who says they have a tough job, believe me, nothing's tougher than being a landmine clearer in Cambodia.
Yeah, exactly right.
That is the world's most stressful job for sure. And so for me, that episode I think is just such a great adventure, and it's tense and it's exciting and it has this great payoff of seeing this cool place. And so I'm really proud of it. I think it's good stuff.
Well, all this stuff is good stuff. The show is called Expedition Unknown, and we have the real life Josh Gates. I am the real life short round. Dr. Gates, you cheat. Dr. Gates, you cheat. amazing talking to you, man. And I'm really looking forward to checking out Expedition Unknown. I actually got all the DVDs for Destination Truth as well. So I've now found some new favorite shows, and it's been great to have you on, man. I really appreciate you sharing these amazing tales.
Hey man, it's been great being here as well. Thank you for having me. And one of these days, we'll have to team up forces and go on an adventure together.
We'll find some adventure. If nothing else, we'll grab a bottle of vodka and we'll find some stuff on our own.
Hey, we could do that. That's an easy adventure.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, buddy.
Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
All right, thanks to Expedition Unknown's Josh Gates, the modern-day Indiana Jones. You can see new episodes every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central on the Travel Channel. They're doing some crazy investigations and explorations. This Thursday, Josh and his team investigate the fall of the Mayan Empire. They unearth ancient Mayan sacrificial altars and human skulls in the caverns underneath the jungles of Mexico. Yeah, that's Expedition Unknown on the Travel Channel. You'll be hooked, I promise. And don't forget, if you live in LA, go check out The Resurrection of Jake the Snake. That's at the Arclight Theater on Sunset Boulevard in LA on Sunday, March 8th at 8 p.m. Still a few tickets left. It's an incredible story about how Diamond Dallas Page and DDP Yoga literally saved Jake's life. We talked about it when Jake and DDP were on Talk is Jericho, and now you can get to see it. If you live in LA, get your tickets to see the documentary at the Arclight on Sunset, Sunday, March 8th at 8 p.m. Don't forget, if you want to get some Talk is Jericho t-shirts, go to ProWrestlingTees.com, T-E-E-S. You can get the Master of Podcasts, the Pod of Thunder, get the Armbar shirt or Jericho Personal Security if you want to do some retro Jericho. And if you live in Ireland, we will see you tonight as the Cinderblock Party World Tour starts in Belfast. It's finally here. We're coming to your city near you in a couple weeks. 5th in Cork, 6th in Dublin, Ireland. Then we jet on over to England, Nottingham, Wolverhampton, Manchester, Glasgow, London, Bristol, Exeter, Southampton, Brighton on March 15th. We get one day off. Then we head to Paris, Pratteln, Switzerland, Munich, Germany, Mannheim, Germany, Bochum, Germany on March 21st. You need to go to FozzyRock.com. Check out all ticket information. There are tickets left to some of the shows. Some of them are close to selling out. So if you're thinking about it, if you're sitting on the fence, get your ass over there, man. Come on. Go rock it with us on the VIP side as well. Come hang out with us. Meet with us. It'll be an experience you'll never, ever forget for the rest of your life. One last thank you to all you guys for supporting the great sponsors on Talk is Jericho. Wouldn't be able to do this for free twice a week without my fruit sponsors, and that includes Amazon. You go to podcastone.com, click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then click on Talk is Jericho. You see all my Amazon links, and every time you do that, Amazon kicks back a little cash to the show with no extra fees or hidden charges. Getting that shopping done. Help me out in the process. I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you for loving me, man. I love to love you, baby. And I want to thank you for joining me. That's it. In the meantime and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. We will see you on Friday with Samoa Joe. He's in the news right now. He just left TNA. He's back in Ring of Honor. He's the hot topic guy. So where else is he going to be? He's going to be here to talk to me on Talk is Jericho with all of you. Samoa Joe coming up on Friday. We'll see you then. Yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.